I do want to thank again Tim O'Malley and all of his good colleagues for their hard work in organizing this conference and for the invitation to speak. It's great to be here. I'm going to begin with a couple of disclaimers and let you slip out if you'd like. First, unlike most of you, I am not an expert liturgist. The closest I get is directing music at my little rural parish every weekend in southern Indiana, and I'll admit that also through my own fault, our liturgies are a bit loose. Although I have theological training, I would not call myself much of an expert theologian or an expert at much of anything. But I do have 2 feet in very different and very interesting worlds. I've worked for about a dozen years at St. Minor, the Benedictine Monastery, and if Benedictines aren't experts in liturgy, I don't know who is, except, of course, the Holy Cross folks up here. And I'd like to think that some appreciation for good liturgy has rubbed off on me, even if I can't actually implement it myself. And also, for the last dozen years, I've run an organic farm, raising fruits and vegetables, free-range eggs, with all of the challenges and satisfactions that that's entailed. So I won't bore you with any more of my bio, but I do have to put in a plug for a book I just wrote with Ave Maria Press out of Notre Dame called A Time to Plant, Life Lessons in Work, Prayer, and Dirt, and I think you can get it in the room next door. So anyway, shameless self-promotion aside, as a Catholic with a strong Benedictine influence, I've thought a lot about the Eucharist. And as a farmer, I've thought a lot about agriculture. So in this talk, I want to put those together and see how they connect. I have to say I am utterly terrified of being in a room with so many experts in liturgy, and so I'll probably make some sort of heretical gaffe that's going to make you wince. Have mercy, please. So before we really get going, I just want to take a poll. How many of you either farm now or grew up on a farm? Oh my gosh. Oh God, yeah, that's why you're here. It's a self-selected audience. Well, it seems that there are others who did not. So I think what I'm going to do first is give you a crash course, a quick and dirty crash course on agriculture. There we go. I'll admit I love farming, and whether it's farming or liturgy, if you love something, everyone thinks that what they love is the most important thing in the world. But so, of course, I think agriculture is important. But I think on some level there's some confirmation for that, given the fact that probably all of us ate today. And most of the people on the planet eat every day. So in terms of the human species and our evolution, agriculture as a way of getting food is actually fairly new on the scene. We've really only been raising domesticated crops and animals for about 10,000 years compared to the, depending on how you count, a couple hundred thousand years that we've been around as a species. And during that all that time prior, we were eating nuts and berries and hunting wild buffalo and boar and bears and all of this. So raising annual grains was the big breakthrough, grains like wheat and maize, barley, because grains can be raised in quantity, they can be stored. Then grain agriculture enabled all sorts of other innovations. Population growth was the big one, which led to the rise of cities and nation states, empires, and of course all of the warfare and slavery, slave labor, I should say, that undergirded much of what we call civilization. So we've come a long way in 10,000 years, and agriculture has utterly changed almost 40% of the Earth's land surface. And especially in the last 100 years, advances in agriculture have fueled an even larger population boom than it began 10,000 years ago. It's important to remember that if we're going to get to 9 billion people this century, we need high and reliable agricultural yields. And yet, today's agriculture has a laundry list of some fundamentally serious problems. For starters, it's no secret that it's heavily dependent on fossil fuels and for fertilizer and also for mechanical labor to drive tractors and harvesters. And when you think about it, think how much energy it takes to pick up the top 6 to 8 inches of about 10% of the Earth's surface and flip it over every year. That's what tillage is. Think about where the energy for that comes from. It comes from, you know, dead dinosaurs. Also, in much of the world, agriculture has depleted and exhausted the soil and has caused much of it to wash away or to blow away, to erode. And just clearing land for agriculture in the first place and then replacing that diverse cleared land with monoculture cropping and also using patented hybrid seeds, all of that's contributed to a large loss of biodiversity from the microbial life of the soil all the way up to the big keystone predators in an ecosystem. In terms of water, modern agriculture has depleted aquifers when you're pumping out of wells to do irrigation, and it's also polluted surface water and groundwater also with pesticides and herbicides and fertilizer runoff. I didn't really realize until recently, I've been thinking and studying a lot about climate change because I'm a climate ambassador for the Catholic Coalition on Climate Change. I didn't realize that modern agriculture and animal husbandry contribute hugely to climate change, possibly even more than power plants or cars or any other single sector. It depends on how you crunch the numbers with that, but it is definitely a positive influence on global warming in the sense that it's causing it, and it's also tremendously fragile. It is vulnerable to disease, to weather, of course, as we've learned this spring, to shortages of fuel or machinery, as the Cubans learned in the special period back in the early 90s. And it's vulnerable to any kind of breakdown in the in that long supply chain between the field and your plate. Food goes through a lot of hands in that supply chain. And finally, the get big or get out mentality of industrial farming has meant, as I've seen in my area, which is depopulated, it's meant the collapse and consolidation of small farms and a kind of a population hemorrhage from rural areas. And along with that, of course, then you have the breakdown in economic and civic life in those rural areas. So it's certainly caused a lot of problems. Okay, that's the bad news. I'm done with bad news. I wanted to get that out of the way in one big chunk. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that how and what we feed ourselves is the fundamental constituent of our civilization, and it's a huge influence on the health of the planet and the health of human communities. So if we don't get agriculture right, not much else matters. And I have to say that for the most part, we're not getting agriculture right these days. I know most of us aren't farmers, and so some of these problems can seem kind of abstract and removed. But as I said earlier, we're all eaters, so each one of us is involved in this. And our food choices are never neutral. Our eating either does good or it does harm to other people or other species or the planet as a whole. So the good news is that there are other and better ways to farm, better for the land, for the farmer, for rural and urban communities. There's a wonderful and burgeoning movement towards smaller scale, more diversified, more labor-intensive agriculture that's locally based and regionally appropriate. And I hear, I've not seen it, but I there's actually a really good farmer's market here in South Bend. And there are markets like that popping up all over the country, not just in big cities, but even in the rural areas where I am. And that's wonderful to see. And what I'm hoping for and working for on our farm is a future where there are actually a lot more people farming, a lot more people on the land, using more labor and knowledge, but less machinery and fuel and chemicals. As I mentioned, I've been studying climate change a lot lately, and I've come to learn that better farming and forestry practices could actually pull out of the atmosphere a huge amount of carbon dioxide and sequester it in the form of organic matter in soils, more than any kind of cap and trade or carbon tax, government scheme, anything like that. I won't bore you with the stats, but if we really did that right, we could pull the CO2 concentration down to pre-industrial levels within a decade or so. So there's great potential there. And because of that and other reasons, I'm actually trying to move our farm beyond just organic farming, which still, I've noticed, we use a lot of diesel fuel. We till a lot. And so we have to fight problems with erosion and other things. On our place, I'm trying to work toward what I would call really a truly regenerative way of growing food and growing fiber for, cotton farmers and things, which in our region, at least, would mimic a forest ecosystem because that's what would be there in before agriculture cleared it. Okay, that's my riff on agriculture. So what do agriculture and the Eucharist have to do with one another? Or agriculture and the Catholic Christian faith, for that matter? On one hand, I don't think the connection's actually all that apparent, because unlike its land-based parent, Judaism, which does have deep agricultural roots and a strong connection to a particular place, Christianity emerged mainly as an urban religion, and it had limited connection to agricultural cycles or the land once it got out of the Galilee. Paul was the quintessential urbanite, and Peter, rural character that he is, he was a fisherman. He wasn't a farmer per se. And the letters of the New Testament, they were not written to country bumpkins out in the hinterlands of Palestine or Greek or Rome. They were written to Christians in large cities like Corinth and Thessalonica and Rome. So on the one hand, Christianity is not necessarily connected to the land. But on the other hand, think about this. Agricultural products, bread and wine, those are the central symbol and practice of Catholic faith. So at least for Catholics, the need for a healthy and regenerative agriculture, it's not just a practical matter in terms of the survival of humanity and this other species and the planet, although that's certainly a big deal. It's also a central spiritual matter. For example, think about what it would mean for us spiritually if the very Eucharistic bread we eat and the very Eucharistic wine we drink come from agricultural practices that degrade land or that contribute to climate change or other environmental pollution, that harm the lives of farm workers and rural communities. That is a really tough question. And I can't answer it, but I wanted to ask it. So if the Eucharist and agriculture are connected, how can those connections benefit both? How can our Catholic faith help us to work for a truly sustainable, regenerative agriculture? And how might healthy agriculture enhance our faith? That's where I'd like to go. I want to start making these connections, first of all, by talking about a paradox that I see at the heart of the Eucharist. Like the cross, the Eucharist is a symbol of brokenness. And yet at the same time, it's an invitation to connection, to wholeness, to integration. And I'm a Catholic convert, so I chose this crazy religion. And I think that's one of the geniuses, I think, about Catholicism, is that unlike some dualistic forms of faith, Catholicism is kata holikos. It's according to the whole. Nothing, at least on its better days, nothing is outside of the scope of the Catholic faith. And again, at its best, Catholicism does try to incorporate and integrate all aspects of existence. It's a religion of belonging, if you will, a religion of the whole. And there's good reason for this, both from theology and also from nature. In terms of the former, we worship a Trinitarian God whose very essence is relationship and who's created a world built on relationships. There is simply no such thing as the isolated individual. We have our very being in relationship with each other, even as I would be careful to say, even as every part of the created order is a thou, to use Martin Buber's language. It has its own uniqueness as well. We're connected and we're unique, just like the Trinity. And in some sense, modern ecological science has come really to its own version of this theological truth. With back to my climate change example, you can tell that's much on my mind these days. In terms of climate change, everything affects everything. My driving habits, even in my little Toyota Corolla, I mean, affect the rainforest in Brazil. Clear-cutting the Brazilian rainforest affects the temperature and rainfall patterns in Russia. And drought in Russia affects the grain prices in Africa, which affects political stability in Egypt. I mean, it is, you get the picture. It is a tangled and complicated web. On the smaller scale, we saw this same kind of interconnection on our farm. When we first moved there, we needed to have a water supply because the county water line was way far away. It would have taken way too much money and trouble to get it to us. So we were going to drill a well, and we had the guy come out, and he said, listen, I'll get you water, but it's not going to be much, and it's not going to be good quality because there have been so many small oil wells and gas wells drilled in our area and then capped off improperly that they basically perforated the water table. And there's salt in the water table. It's just really a poor quality water table. because of human invention. So anyway, we dug a pond instead. We figured, okay, we'll make it with the clean water so we don't get any runoff from other fields, and that'll we'll pump out of it for our house and for our irrigation. And that was fine. It worked out great until my neighbor started spraying Roundup in his fields right next to our pond on a windy day. And so, you know, so I run over there, and we have to work this thing out where he's not going to spray close when it's windy. Interconnected. And, of course, the rainfall. We're dependent on rainfall. We can't just, I've watched our pond level drop in the middle of summer, and that matters to me if it rains or not in terms of what we can do with our crops and flushing our toilets and all of that. So it's kind of ironic that here on this farm where we've trying so hard to be off-grid and independent and ruggedly independent and Daniel Boone, we're connected. We're deeply and wonderfully connected. So if we can't avoid being part of, even on a farm, if you can't avoid being part of this big complicated mess of interconnected relationships, the Eucharist prompts us to ask about the nature of those relationships. If you're going to be in them, what are they like? And my answer to that is, we can either act as part of a communion, or we can act like a cancer. We can act as a part of a healthy whole, or as something that's self-serving and ultimately self-destructive. So obviously I'm rooting for communion, and I hope you all are too. and so I'd like to reflect on a couple of ways that the Eucharist invites us into communion. It helps us to integrate, and I'll unpack each of these. It helps us to integrate the material and the spiritual, helps us to integrate the gifts of creation with our work in it, especially, of course, our agricultural work. And it calls us to right relationships with each other, with the creation, and with the Creator. So let me start with what I consider to be the very basic rules of Sacramental Theology 101. God made the world and continues to make it on purpose, and the world is good. Creation is not just stuff. It's infused with a spiritual dimension. It's a sacrament, as the Passionist Thomas Berry said. It shapes our poetic and our religious imaginations. It points us to God. What that means, then, is that while we certainly can encounter God within the church walls at the source and summit of our faith, we can also meet God beyond the walls of the church, and I'm sure all of you have, in the natural world, in everyday relationships, among friends and family and strangers. And as a farmer, I have to say, I'm drawn to how the scriptures describe food and eating as especially powerful means of revelation. You think about how important food was in Jesus' teaching and ministry, about his parables, the sower and the seed, and the vineyard owner, and the laborers he hired at various times of the day, and the wicked tenants, all of those agricultural parables, and all the meals Jesus had with sinners like Zacchaeus, the wedding feast at Cana, the Last Supper, and the resurrection breakfasts, etc. The resurrected Christ was made known in the breaking of the bread. So the larger point is that whether you're talking about church buildings or mountain peaks or farm fields or dinner tables, all of these realms are material realms. All of them are made of wood and stone and concrete and metal and dirt and flesh and blood. So the material isn't just a path to the divine. It's the only path, at least in this world. There's no such thing as a disembodied spirituality for human creatures, because all of us are material bodies living in a material world. So that's Sacramental Theology of 101. If matter has a spiritual dimension, then we have the duty to learn from it. We have to read the book of nature, and that's what I'm doing as a farmer all the time. I'm figuring out what my land is telling me. And of course, it also matters how we treat it. That's one of the problems, I think, with modern industrial agriculture, is it ultimately doesn't attach any spiritual significance to land or animals or even people. And on the other hand, you know, what I'd like to think is that if you think that land has a sacramental, sacred quality given by the Creator, you're going to do your best to try and tend and nurture it. And, you know, I have to admit, as a farmer, I actually can sort of see both sides of this equation, you know, the spiritual and the practical, if you want. A close neighbor of ours has a field that he plows every year, puts it to corn or beans, and he doesn't put winter cover crops or anything like that. So over the winter and in hard rains, it's rolling land, so he gets these just gullies eroded in the folds of the hills. And we walk past that on our walks around the neighborhood, and it just, I mean, here I am trying to take care of my place as best I can, and I see that right next door. It just, you know, it grinds my gears. But then, on the other hand, that's in me too, because we'll also take walks in our woodlot, and I'm just looking around saying, okay, that tree is too close to that one, this one's too crooked, that one's the wrong species, I'm going to have to take this out, make firewood of that one. I'm sort of thinking in terms of board feed and cords of firewood. And my kids and my wife, they're like William Blake. They see the angels and the fairies perching in the tree limbs, and they would never let me cut down certain trees just because they're crooked or anything like that. And they have that sense of the sacred that the practical, pragmatic guy often struggles to have. So I don't actually find it easy to hold the material and the spiritual together and to see that one is the pathway to the other. But that is exactly what the Eucharist calls us to do. The spiritual realm needs the material to be really incarnate. That's what a sacramental world is all about. And the material needs the spiritual. That's what's going to inspire, ultimately, careful stewardship. In my view. So, when we say that the Eucharist is the fruit of the earth and the work of human hands, what we're essentially saying is that God's gift and human work belong together. Have any of you ever heard of Matthew Crawford? Okay, none in the morning session. I thought he would have been better known by this. In any case, in 2006, he published an essay called Shop Class as Soul Craft, and then he later turned it into a book. He's a very interesting guy. He's got a PhD in political science, or political philosophy from the University of Chicago, but then he's also a motorcycle mechanic and an electrician, so he holds these two worlds together. And in this essay and book, he argues that blue-collar trades like carpentry, plumbing, mechanicing, welding, they actually present great intellectual and, of course, physical challenges and deep psychic satisfactions. And he actually kind of reams a lot of white-collar work as being disembodied and routinized and brainless and kind of outsourceable to China or India. And actually, my experience on our farm has confirmed this. When I built our house, I built it all myself, and I had to figure out, for example, how to cut the compound angles in the roof rafters when it met a different angle of the roof. So you had two different angles at once. And when I finally got that right after about six tries, I mean, I felt that was my doctoral dissertation right there. It was, you know, deeply satisfying and hard, and harder in some sense than a lot of the work I do at Meinrad, which requires a graduate degree and a tie and everything else. So Crawford is calling for a new appreciation of craftsmanship, a craftsmanship as honorable, edifying, necessary work. And I recognize there's a gender bias in that word. Craftspeopleship doesn't quite come off the tongue right. So I don't think he means a gender bias, and I don't either, but I did want to note that. So I bring up this essay because raising food, at least raising food well, requires exactly the kind of craftsmanship that Crawford is talking about. Growing food well is hard. It requires knowledge from books, from others, from paying attention to the land, most of all. It requires labor and discipline. What I've learned is crops don't wait on you. They don't wait till it's convenient for you to weed or harvest or anything. And animals that need your attention, they don't care if you're sick or if you're tired. They need your attention now. Farming also requires a lot of skill and creativity. And it's not actually just in raising crops. It's also in marketing them. We've got a friend in the area who raises grass-fed organic milk. He's got a dairy herd. He's a really good farmer. He's done it for a long time. It's a great product. We get our milk from him. And yet, he is really struggling financially right now because Organic Valley, the organic milk co-op, yanked his contract because he lives too far out for them to send a truck economically to pick up his milk. And so now he's scrambling to build this other part onto his dairy parlor where he can make specialty cheeses. You know, he's having to innovate, and I mean, the jury's still out. I don't know if he's going to be able to make it. So it's not just the hard part of actually raising something, it's then marketing it as well. So if I have any beef with what Crawford is trying to do, it seems like he's got kind of this this rugged, stoic ideal of craftsmanship, and I think that runs the risk of believing that everything is in our hands and within our control. So basically, if you're a master of the trade, it's not that far to think you might be able to be master of the world or have control of all circumstances. And the Eucharist teaches the exact opposite. The Eucharist reminds us that the materials we work with are gift, the fruit of the earth. We didn't create them, we don't own them, and in most ways they're out of our control. But even the ability to work with the stuff of earth is a gift and a privilege. We didn't make the human hands. We didn't make our faculties. And so, of course, the foundation of these gifts is love. The Creator's love for us and for the world, our love for the world and the Creator. And the Eucharist, then, it's an invitation to see agricultural work with new eyes as an honorable, essential trade, like Crawford describes, that integrates craftsmanship with love and gift. So work and gift belong together in the human vocation. Beyond uniting the material and the spiritual and bringing together work and gift, the Eucharist invites us to communion, what I call true belonging, rooted in justice. It's a symbol of right relationships with each other in all times and places, with all of creation and with God. The Eucharist is food, of course, and I'm a farmer, so of course I think again about these connections in terms of food. Eating could promote healthy relationships with each other. How many of you have seen Babette's Feast? Of course, liturgists always watch Babette's Feast. And I mean, it's a perfect example of how food can be a healing and integrative force in community. It can also promote justice for everyone who raised the food and got it to the table. It can connect us meaningfully to the earth, especially if we grow some food or know those folks who do grow it. And as I'm trying to do on our farm, it can help heal degraded land. Our farm was ruined when I got it, and it's still half ruined, even a dozen years later after a lot of care. Good farming heals land, and it promotes what I dream of, this beautiful kind of working landscape of well-tended farms and forests. You can probably hear a lot of Wendell Berry coming through in my talk. He's been a great mentor to me. And I think that as we work toward a just and flourishing human communion and ecological communion based on good stewardship, we will discover Christ to be alive in our midst, he in whom all things hold together. So if the Eucharist calls us into loving and just communion, I want to put a little flesh on what that might look like and what it actually might require of us. I'm a farmer, I have to end sort of practically. It's no surprise to those of us probably in this room that we in the developed world live far better than many, many folks on the globe. We've got better health care, we've got enough food, safe drinking water, education, etc. And I'd venture to say that this inequality bothers some of us in this room, and we rightly want others to be able to share in our standard of living. The problem, of course, is that our standard of living, at least in terms of how much of the earth's resources it takes to provide our food and our raw materials and energy, you know, it really is based on us taking a disproportionate share. And if everybody were to come up to our standard of living, we would actually need five earths to supply all of those needs. I think in the face of that, it sort of puts the lie to a really strong temptation in this day and age to put unjustified faith in technology to solve these issues. I mean, everybody remembers how Thomas Malthus famously predicted that we would outstrip our food supply and the whole human population would collapse. But then along came chemical fertilizers and advanced seed genetics and tractors and combines, and presto, there's enough food. And we put Malthus back on the shelf to collect dust. Of course, we forget how all of that productive agriculture ruined a good bit of our cropland. So we do have these historical examples of a dramatic increase in crop yields through technology. And I think that can lead us to think that we'll find a way. Somehow the scientists will find a way to keep providing for all of our basic needs, the food, the shelter, energy, etc., plus all of our what I would call perceived needs of comfort and convenience, plus also all of our habits of superfluous consumption, and that the developing world is going to be able to enjoy the same thing. Somehow, I mean, talk about pie in the sky. We're going to find some cheap form of renewable energy. We'll have hydroponic GMO crops grown in a Monsanto warehouse, and we'll desalinate seawater, and we'll all drive around in solar-powered cars made out of recycled pop cans. I don't think so. I mean, maybe. I'd love to think that we could manage that, and maybe to some extent we will. But okay, maybe I'm a pessimist, but in my experience of farming and working with, we've got solar power on our farm, it's shown me what it really does take to produce food and energy. And it makes me think that full-fledged faith in a technological revolution, that's a fantasy faith. It's actually an idolatrous faith. And I believe we'll see that it is short-lived. Because it ignores some basic laws of physics and biology. And in some sense, it's also actually an insult to those who are suffering. I'm not all that convinced how deep, I'm as guilty as any. I'm not sure how deep my solidarity really goes if I feel heartbroken about the plight of folks in the developing world, but I'm not willing to give up my iPad. And I'm not trying to guilt folks who have iPads by any means. But it's hard to know what to give up. But I do think it's necessary. If the Eucharist calls us to solidarity in Christ, it also calls us to sacrifice like Christ, both so that there's enough to go around, but also so that we have some meaningful connection to those who have less. And I think one practical way to do this every day is with food, eating mindfully, just as we do at the Eucharist. That would probably mean eating fewer calories. It would mean eating more simply and lower on the food chain, not quite as much meat, supporting good farming practices, maybe even growing some of our own food, even when it's not easy or cheap. Okay, if I stopped at this point, this talk would be pretty much like any other talk on justice issues. Big problems in the world, we should feel guilty about them because we're largely responsible, and we should change our ways and do something about it. I mean, that's kind of the equation. Should. And in addition to shoulding all over you, as my wife puts it, I've kind of put the should on steroids because I brought the Eucharist into it. You know, that's the central core of our faith, and it's what requires us to relate in fundamentally different ways to our food, our land, and each other. I mean, the Eucharist isn't a spectator sport. So if the talk ended here, I wouldn't blame you if you felt kind of overwhelmed and depressed. But it won't end here, even though I'm over time. I don't care how compelling a case that I or anyone else might make for us to change our ways. If that case is fueled mainly by a sense of duty and moral obligation, it simply is not going to get off the ground. Because only the very few kind of ubermenschen, hyper-disciplined, self-righteous willpower addicts are going to be on board with it and be able to make the kind of changes that are necessary. And that's not going to be nearly enough to make a difference. So I think that real change is actually going to start happening not when we gird up our loins and all of that, but when we begin to find ourselves amazed and moved at the Eucharist, the mystery of the Eucharist, which unites heaven and earth, material and spiritual, gift and work, and all of us together, and to the creation and to God. To put it another way, I think the Eucharist is essentially an invitation to do what my kids do on the 4th of July fireworks. They keep staring and squealing with delight and shouting over and over again, essentially, wow. The Eucharist, like fireworks and good poetry, it is an invitation not just to do the right thing, but to marvel at the beauty and the wonder of the good and God-given world. And from wonder, it's actually a very short step to what I feel is one of the most essential parts of the Eucharistic prayer. Father, all-powerful and ever-living God, we do well always and everywhere to give you thanks and praise. The Eucharist is the Church's ongoing act of thanksgiving for the gift God has given us, the gift of each other, the gift of a creation that feeds and sustains us all. It stems from wonder, but it's also a spiritual discipline that needs to be cultivated every day. And it's a powerful antidote to that grim, humorless, kind of teeth-gritted, morally upright and morally uptight way of trying to bring about change in our agricultural practices or change in our community life, any sort of brokenness that needs healing. And finally, one more caution. It's easy to turn even the practice of gratitude into yet one more thing I should be doing. If I've learned anything from a dozen years of living really close to the land and trying to steward it well, it's that, you know, God calls us to live a healthy and a healing life, not just out of moral obligation for justice, although that's important, but because at the core, if you forget everything else, at the core, it's actually a lot of fun. It is full of deep pleasures and satisfactions. It's filled with joy. As Jason will talk about, the gospel is good news. Living in this world rightly is good news. It should be good news. Oh, there's the should again. there we go. And I have to be honest, I would have run out of hope long ago. Our life on the farm has been hard. It has been very hard and frustrating and discouraging. And I would have run out of hope a long time ago if it were not for the experience of things like watching my kids laugh their heads off running across our fields, you know, with their faces and clothes just totally stained with strawberry juice or blackberry juice. And in fact, that is one of my daughters. So I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not. And I would have quit tilting at windmills long ago. I would have quit building windmills long ago if it were not for these kinds of simple pleasures of the, you know, the early spring greens and the sweet corn, the squash, the new potatoes, the blueberries shared with family and friends. So to conclude, whether it's around the Lord's table or our kitchen table, which on some level are the same table, that's the invitation of the Eucharist. Give thanks for the great gifts of this good earth. Wonder at the beauty of God's creation and work and live in a way that all people and all creatures at all times and in all places may feast and be filled with joy. Thank you.